And Martin, are you there? Martin, if you'll hit star six, that'll get you to us so you can speak. Every once in a while, Martin.
Yes,
okay, perfect. I can hear you. All right, let's go ahead. Okay. Let's go ahead and begin. Welcome to the AngelPool.org conference call. This is Michael Price. I serve as the 2011 volunteer chair of AngelPool, and I'll be moderating the call today. We have an excellent speaker, Martin Varsovsky, on growth areas for angel investments, how to make good selections, and he'll be walking you through some of his portfolio companies that he decided to fund and how he made those decisions. First, some housekeeping instructions. Everyone is currently in mute. After Martin's remarks, I will then provide instructions to unmute your microphones to be able to ask questions. For those joining the call for the first time, AngelPool.org is made up of and serves the leaders of angel groups across North America and is dedicated to helping those leaders build strong angel groups in their cities to drive jobs, innovations, and exciting new companies. For those angel groups that need additional capital to complete a seed round or that would like to access more high-quality deal flow, the AngelPool Syndication Network is now the world's largest, providing easy monthly access to a large number of other angel groups and deals within their region for additional funding or quality deal flow. AngelPool.org also organizes knowledge and educational events like this one to help angel groups and their angels better fulfill their missions of helping entrepreneurs be more successful, so their portfolios in turn will also hopefully be more successful. With that, let's go ahead and begin. Today's speaker is Martin Varsovsky, ranked one of Business Week's top 25 active angels, who's made a string of good selections using very simple criteria he'll be explaining. He keeps many of his thoughts and notes on his blog, which is at martinvarsovsky.net. And incidentally, before I continue with his introduction, let's see if we can get most people either to his blog directly. Or you can go to our we've got kind of an expedited way in which we could go there. But if everyone could go to martinvarsovsky.net, and let me spell that out to you. That is M-A-R-T-I-N, Varsovsky, V-A-R-S-A-V-S-K-Y.net. Let me do that again. That is Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, Varsovsky, V-A-R-S-A-V-S-K-Y.net. Martin, next time we'll have your mom give you an easier name. And if everyone could please go there, and Martin will navigate some of his investments and some of his investment criteria, and will kind of guide us around as he makes his remarks. Some of his many investments include Wikio, NetVibes, Places, Doppler, Tumblr, Technorati, Eolia, Seismic, Avooz, Manamia, Juiced, Money Tracking, 23andMe, Auro Biosciences, Sonico, Dinero Mail, Sevenload, VPod, and Zing. He also serves as CEO of Phone, the largest Wi-Fi community in the world, with over 3 million phone Wi-Fi spots and over 5 million users. Phone's partners include BT, Comstar, SFR France, SoftBank, and Zone Portugal. Zone's and Phone's investors include British Telecom, the Coral Group, Google, Index Ventures, Sequoia Capital, and Skype. With that introduction, welcome Martin. And Martin, the mic is all yours. Thank you for agreeing to speak to the group.
Well, thank you, Michael, and thanks to the whole group for attending this call. What I wanted to do is briefly guide you through my life as an entrepreneur, as an investor. So in the right side of my blog, you have, as you scroll down, you will see a section that's called Companies I Started. And after that, you will see a section called My Investments. So I should first say that until 5 years ago, I was only an entrepreneur. I was not an investor. I became an investor through my mentoring activities. So I don't have a fund. I invest through my holding company, Just Yak, and it's my own money that I invest. I have not raised outside money, or I'm not a VC. The money that I have at the yard comes from Jazztel, Yadocom, and Vidatel. These are the biggest exits that I've had as an entrepreneur. Jazztel is a company that I started with around $5 million, and when I sold it was worth $1.2 billion, and I had around 20% of that company. It is now the second largest publicly traded telecom operator in Spain, and sells DSL services, mainly on fiber optic connections. Yadocom is a company that I started with around $45 million investment, and I sold it for around $700 million to Deutsche Telekom. At that point, it was the second largest internet company in Spain. Viettel, I started with $200,000. So one exit was $700 million for Jazztel, $1.2 billion for Viettel, around $700 million for Yadocom. Medicor is a small company that I did that is was actually one of my first companies. It's still in Canada and it's a very small company, but still exists. And then Fon is the company that I'm the CEO of now, and it's the largest Wi-Fi network in the world. It's a company that has a unique characteristic of we sell Wi-Fi routers that share some of the extra bandwidth. They are available in the States, but we're very small in the States. We're our success is in Europe and in Asia. We plan to come to the States this year. TechCrunch had an article about us on the last round we did to enter the United States, and you'll be hear about us more this year. So Fon is the company that I'm the CEO of. Now, in terms of my investment philosophy, as I said, it started through my mentoring, and I invest in companies whose products I use, whose entrepreneurs I like to hang out with, at a valuation that I can stomach. Okay, so that is my investment philosophy. Products I use, investors I like to hang out, entrepreneurs I like to hang out with, at valuations that I can, that I find reasonable. Okay. Now, what you will see here on the right is a list of these companies, and they cover three areas: internet, then biotech, and alternative energy. But mostly, they're internet companies. As an investor, though, my biggest success has been in the alternative energy sector. There's a company there called Eolia, which is the second from the right. This company is in Spain, and it's been an incredible success. This company was started out of my office by the former managing director of Jazztel, my investment company. Eolia this year will have an EBITDA of $150 million of EBITDA in only 5 years. It is a quite sizable wind generator, wind electricity, or wind farm developer and operator of wind farms. And these wind farms are in Spain, but they're also in as far as Mexico or Germany or some other countries. So this company, as I said, fits my criteria. The entrepreneur who started it was the former head of my holding company, but also a dear friend who went to Columbia University with me. We did the MBA together. We graduated in 1985, so we know each other for many years. He's also happens to be the godfather of my third child, and he's a dear friend. So he's an entrepreneur I like to hang out with a product I love to use because I love wind-generated electricity. You would be surprised to hear that on a windy day in Spain, 25% of the electricity of Spain comes from wind. That is very, very different situation from the United States, where wind energy is practically a non-factor. In Spain, we've subsidized it, and we certainly have benefited from subsidies at Eolia. But as I said, all the companies in this sector now, well, Spain has the largest alternative energy company in the world. It's called Iberdrola Renovables. And Eolia is a big player, and the company is worth around $1 billion now. So Eolia is the biggest success that I have had. Then I invested in another alternative energy company that's called Nexis that has been a moderate success. We invested $400,000 and we got $20 million out of that company. So moderate in the sense that in size it's small, but as an investment was a very good one. Nexis, as opposed to Eolia, which actually builds and operates wind farms, Nexis is like a company that finds potential sites, and that's the seed development for wind farms. And I think that is as far as alternative energy. I will move on now to biotechnology. I started a company with a Nobel Prize when I was 24 or 25 years old. I'm 50 now, so that was 25 years ago. I met by chance a Nobel Prize medical doctor, Cesar Milstein, at Cambridge University, started at some kind of family holiday, and we hit it off, and we with him and another Argentine, because I'm originally Argentine, with another Argentine doctor at Cambridge, Claudio Cuello, we started Medicore Sciences. So I've been somewhat involved with biotech since 1985. I also went back to school, like in 1987, to study a year of immunology, and I became very interested in biotech. So my two biotech investments now are 23andMe and Aura Biosciences. 23andMe was started by a friend of mine, Ivy Bonchinsky, who's the wife of Sergey, who started Google. And I came across the project when it was just an idea. I was fascinated by it. 23andMe is, maybe some of you have used the product. You pay $199 now, and you send your saliva sample to 23andMe, who then tells you a lot about your genome, about your family origins, the history of your gene pool, and your potential relatives, and a lot about your family history. But then concretely, it tells you a lot about potential medical problems that you may have, or the opposite. A low likelihood of having problems which may actually be terrorizing you or worrying you. In my case, I was very interested in 23andMe for fear, really, of certain diseases that were running in my family, like heart disease and Parkinson's disease. It was a big relief for me to find out that I tested that I had very low risk of those, of heart disease and Parkinson's disease. But that doesn't mean that I cannot get them. It means that I'm less likely, or that certain genes that are markers for those diseases, which are present in my family but not in me, not expressed in me. So maybe coming from one parent, but I express the genes of the other parent, and so on. So 23andMe is full putting together a pool of genetic information, mainly in the United States, which is the perfect country to do this, as opposed to a country that would have a homogeneous population, like Japan. 23andMe strategically located in the United States because the United States is a country of immigrants, and just by testing people in the United States, you can test the whole world. Okay, Aura Biosciences is a very different idea from 23andMe. While 23andMe is about something like a search engine of genes or a Google of genes, or Aura Biosciences is working on a very targeted approach to cancer treatment. Basically, Elizabeth de los Pinos, the scientist who started Aura Biosciences, was a student of mine. For the last 12 years, I've been teaching entrepreneurship at Instituto de Empresa, which is the fourth or fifth best ranked business school in Europe. And Elizabeth was a student of mine, a brilliant student. She did great work. A scientist who did an MBA, and I had her in my entrepreneurship class. And Aura Biosciences is based on using the brilliance of viruses, if you may call it like that, in targeting organs. Hepatitis, for example, is a virus that targets the liver. And we don't know how to send medication to the liver. And we don't know how to send medication to many organs. And so when we give somebody chemotherapy, because if we were shooting in the air, hoping that we kill the cancer cells, well, hoping we don't kill the individual. And it is a very primitive technique that unfortunately we've been using for so long without finding a better way of targeting chemotherapy. So Elizabeth's idea is to strip viruses of their genetic component and instead to put poison or chemotherapy inside the viruses and use the envelopes of these viruses, which are somehow smart enough to let they enter the liver, to deliver the poison to the tumor, okay? So it's using the evolutionary wisdom of viruses to deliver chemotherapy. So I found this fascinating. Again, it's my criteria, accepting the fact that I don't use it, and I hope not to use it, but if I ever have to use it, I'd like to know that I have something to do with making it happen, because it's something that could help a lot of people. And, of course, high risk, and of course it may not help, and the whole approach may fail. Investing in biotech is extremely risky, and my advice for everyone there should be done in a very diversified manner and with small amounts of money. And it may be a border between philanthropy and investing. But with all those caveats, I think it is worthwhile to invest in Aura Biosciences. And I'm very happy to have invested in that company. Now, for the sake of time, I'm not going to cover all the companies except that I'm going to show you that as you continue below, you'll see exit. Okay, so on the right side of my blog, martinborsowski.net, you have the companies I started. As you scroll down, you first find the companies I started, then you find my investments, then you find exits, and then you find the companies that actually were failures, which is these two companies that are here, which were failures. So two of them, Einsteinet and Novak, have failed. And we can talk about those two. I wanted to speak about the exit, okay? Yes, it were companies where I've done pretty well. Companies that were sold. In the case of Dinero Mayo, it was recently sold to Naspers. Naspers is a very smart South African internet company that invested very little money in Tencent in China. Their stake is worth $14 billion. It's kind of like the Peter Thiel story that the Americans don't know, because it's South Africa, China, but the money devaluation, it's not $500,000, it's $5 billion, but it's $14 billion, and I don't know how much money, but it was certainly not a lot. So Naspers is a company that's buying a lot of other companies, but all this is happening outside of USA. Naspers bought Dinero Mayo. Nokia bought Doppler, Nokia bought Places, Eolia bought El Moralejo, which is a wind farm that I built and sold to Eolia. And then Zing is like the LinkedIn of Europe. It is a company that is publicly traded. I think it's worth around $250 million in the German public market. So anyway, that's a company that I also sold. Okay, so going back to the other companies that I'm still an investor in, Friend is a very large, a very popular Android iPhone app that allows you to communicate on Messenger, like via Messenger, via the competitor of FaceTime, you know, the Apple application where people see each other. Or it's like FaceTime for Android. Bling Nation is about payment systems and new payment systems. Asa is an Argentine company that is a computer sort of like consulting company. Hipertextual and Meneame are two Spanish companies that are one has 9 million uniques, the other one 4 million uniques. They're profitable, and they are very successful in the Spanish internet. They're news, like sort of like Hipertextual is like the TechCrunch network in Spanish. I mean, it is kind of like Reddit or Dig, but they're both profitable, going nicely. Money Tracking is struggling and probably will be another company that fails. I invested only in 80,000 dollars in that company. I'm always translating from euros to dollars.
Oh, Martin. Martin, by the way, we've got a number of questions so far. Do you want me just to ask the questions from the group? A number of them have emailed or texted in questions. Do you want me just to go ahead and give those questions to you as you go?
Yes, please.
Okay. One of the questions. Looks like this was from the Northeast, just north of New York. You've made a lot of investments in the mobile sector. Can you talk for a minute on some of the opportunities that you see in mobile? And what opportunities you might see arising in the next 2 to 3 years, perhaps in mobile, that might be interesting to the others.
Okay, the biggest trends I see in mobile now. Well, you heard today probably of the Rovio investment of $42 million. That was done by my partners, partly by my partners at Fon in Atomico, which is Niklas Benstrom, who started Skype, and some other investors. Angry Birds is the famous game that I'm sure many of the people who are on the call at least have heard about. It's a Swedish company. Well, gaming, I'm also looking at an investment right now in a gaming company. I like to play games occasionally. Mobile games are fun, are somewhat addictive. iPod games. I mean, I think that now I heard today or read something that Nintendo was saying that the biggest competitor now was not Sony, was not SoFi, was Apple, right? And so iPad games, in the future Android games, not so big now, but they will be iOS, iPhone games. So that's one big trend. It's a lot of opportunities. But of course, games, investing in games is like the game itself, or it's like gaming or like gambling. It is very easy to do a game, and extremely hard to make a successful game. So you have to be very careful investing in games. I think you have to have a sense when you see a game. Is this something that you would like to play? And if you don't play games, I would never invest in them because you wouldn't have any sense. And I actually haven't invested in any games so far. So that's one huge trend. Another trend that I see very different, that I'm looking at a company, investing in this company, has to do with what formed that. I've invested in a company that's called Sputnik, and I own like a third of that company. It's in the list. And Sputnik is an MVNO, like a mobile operator, a mobile virtual operator for gadgets. So not for people, but for gadgets. And there's a big trend right now of gadgets that sign on to the internet without people knowing, okay? Or maybe if they know, they don't care. And I'm talking about all sorts of things. It can be utility readers. It can be the Kindle, for example, that people don't need to open an account with T-Mobile or AT&T or whatever to use a Kindle. So that's another mega trend, the trend of T-Mobile, which is sometimes referred to as M2M, machine to machine. It is the connection of gadgets by themselves to the internet, and the gadget maker pays you as the provider of the service and not the actual end consumer, okay? Then there's another big trend in mobile, which is about metered data plans or Wi-Fi. Like, we at Phone are on the Wi-Fi trend, but there's another trend, which is compressing data that gets to phones, because now every carrier is going to a metered data plan, facing a big shortage, even with LTE being deployed. And already there's a big shortage. I mean, if you have an iPhone, you use your iPhone in America, you will experience that shortage, right? You experience the shortage. So
not on AT&T.
Companies that are thinking of
not on AT&T. Yeah. We don't know what that is.
Yeah.
It's unlimited bandwidth at AT&T and perfect connections.
Exactly. So when I go to the States, I actually get a couple of phones, and if I throw one out of the window, I still have another one. so the frustration of people that they're being sold a product that conceivably is a magical product and allows you to watch movies like an iPhone. You can go to the iTunes shop. You can watch Mad Men or your favorite TV series. But the truth is that when you try to do that, many times you can't. And they force you to go to Wi-Fi, or they don't give it to you, or they... the iPhone is a product that is sold, and so many times it sends you to Wi-Fi, right? So Phone is about that. But then I've been looking at other companies that are looking at compression techniques and intermediate servers, so you can compress everything that goes to your mobile device, your smartphone. So that's another trend I see about dealing with scarcity, network scarcity. So with that, maybe I should take another question. I don't want any more on the mobile trend.
Another question was, on your criteria, of an entrepreneur whom you'd like to hang out with, a product you would love to use, and evaluation that is reasonable. How do you determine so early on, what valuations might be reasonable? Any rules of the road that have worked well for you?
Well, there's price. There's a sense of price and value that I maybe intuitively have in my life. For example, when I was offered 550 million euros, which is around $700 million, maybe a bit more, for the company Yahoo.com, I had a sense that the price was above the value, and I sold the company, right? And indeed, I was right, because that company sold again 10 years later for the same amount. So it took 10 years for the company to be worth the same, right? I had a sense that I had a valuable company, but not as valuable as I was being offered, the money I was being offered in 2001. So I just have an intuition about price and value when somebody gives me a price or a valuation that I think is way above value, I say no. I'm not trying to dodge the question, but I don't think there's any formula to answer that. It's just like a gut feeling of what the price is for something. And then you say, how does that relate to what people are telling me? So I have a sense of value, and I hope that price is below that or at that, but not above that.
Okay. Another question that was asked was, what was learned from your failures? Any important lessons or takeaways?
Well, yes, let's go over this failure, this company called EinsteinNet, you know. EinsteinNet has been my biggest failure. I lost over $50 million personally in EinsteinNet. My investors lost like $150 million. So it's the biggest black eye of my investment career. And EinsteinNet used to have intelligence was on the net, that is the same cloud computing, the same concept of cloud computing. And we went through, and we were building data centers and hosting what we were hoping were going to be, was going to be the world of cloud. We had an amazing technology to host cloud computing, and we were doing very poorly. And I basically sold the company for nothing but saved the jobs of the employees to another company in 2004. And then cloud computing really took off in 2006, 2007, and now cloud computing is really big. So my lesson there was to stick to my instinct. So when I was faced again with phone, we almost failed again. Phone was starting in 2006, and by 2008, it was only doing $5 million in revenues and losing $6 million, and my partners left me or abandoned me, some of the best partners in the world, Sequoia, Google, whatever, but they just didn't think phone was going to work. And I remember my internet failure and how close I had been to succeeding with the technology too early. So I told my partners that I would fund phone personally with a loan, and I wouldn't dilute them because I wanted to keep a very good relationship with these investors who are some of the best in the world. And indeed, I loaned the company money myself. And then our revenues grew from like $5 million to $40 million last year. We went from losing $5 million to making $4 million. And this year we're probably going to get close to doing $100 million and making close to 10 in profit. So I think the lesson that I learned after EinsteinNet was that I tend to be very early with my technology predictions, and I have to have runway and money The phone already has paid me back my loan, so I haven't diluted any of my partners. They're super happy with me now. So it was a lesson to just hang in there and believe in my instincts for technology after such a big loss with Einstein.
Okay, good. Another question about green energy. That's an amazing statistic that you mentioned in Spain, where 25% of energy is generated from wind on a good windy day. You know, out there. What do you think the future? You know, what do you think the future is in the U.S. for wind energy, and what are some of the other green energy sectors that you think will become the fastest growth sectors that would be, you know, some of the better bets?
Well, I think that the biggest problem that the U.S. has is that it has a democratic system that is surprisingly influenced by the decadent and uninfluenced by the up-and-coming. When you have a transformation, like an industry transformation, and that's been true of the United States many times, that Europe has had an advantage, or even China has had an advantage. Of course, there's a lot of things that the U.S. has an advantage, but I mean in this one it doesn't, which is the lobbying power of the decadent. So when you have decadent industries, like polluting decadent industries, but that still employ a lot of people and still generate most of the electricity and so on, and you're trying to do away with those, it is difficult because power is so distributed in America between Congress, the president, that presidential power is really very limited and eroded by Congress, and then it's eroded by the governors and the mayors and so it is hard to come up with a policy like the Spanish policy or the German policy or the Danish policy. These countries that are using enormous, enormous percentage of their energy needs are being already met by alternative energy, right? And even on the face of the BP disaster and all these things that happen in America, somehow they don't seem to translate. So what does America need? It needs a grid, okay? Like, America has this issue that where it has wind, it doesn't have a lot of people who use the energy, and then where it has the need, it doesn't have the wind. So Germany, France, Spain, we built grid. So we could connect all these wind farms, and we could connect the places where there's wind to the places where people need electricity. So America has all the solar energy needs, it has all the wind energy needs, but it doesn't have a grid. It also doesn't have a pricing policy for energy. And that is essential to develop wind energy, that 20-year pricing guarantees, like, and I know Spain overdid it, by the way. There's a lot of people who criticize that energy is too expensive in Spain as a result of this policy. And that's true. I mean, maybe Spain overdid it, but America certainly hasn't done it at all. So America needs a grid, needs a national policy. For example, what European governments do is they tax energy more. They take advantage. Let's say when oil goes from 150 to 40 or 50, like it did recently, they don't let the price of fuel fall like that. And they build reserves, like tax reserves. That, like, we don't see the energy. So I can see why people in America may buy like a gigantic truck and then a Prius. And then it's like people are lost because the energy swings are gigantic. And so I would be careful, or I would be afraid of investing in alternative energy in America. People have been trying to do that since the 70s and getting burned. Because first it was great, and then the oil prices go down. Because oil prices can go down a lot as well, you know. And so I don't see the conditions in America to risk it with what we did in Orolia.
Any technologies in renewable energy that you think hold the greatest promise?
Well, you see, in general, there's America, let's say Europe and America together are fighting wars and investing trillions of dollars in my opinion, useless wars, obviously. But this is something that, like in Afghanistan now, whatever, when really, and we want to be safe and we want to have an energy, access to energy. But in the meantime, while we do all this, every night in the United States and every night in Europe, we get the electricity we produce through means that cannot be turned off at night. And we throw it in the ground, right? So we ground enormous amounts of energy because we don't know what to do with it at night, more in America than in Europe, but in Europe too. And so, obviously, electric cars make a lot of sense because you can charge them for free at night when nobody's using the energy. Israel is doing this, and Denmark is beginning to do this, and the pricing of electricity should be very much hourly dependent, but to charge things at night would mean transportation for free. I think that, again, people have to be careful in making these investments in America because other than some people in California and New York who actually think like Europeans and vote like Europeans, most of people in America like big cars, are in love with spending a lot of energy, and it is only if $10 a gallon fuel would make them change their mind. But other than $10 a gallon fuel, it is difficult that they will change their mind, and they will find electric cars unsafe and uncomfortable and short range, and they will find a lot of reasons. The only thing that will make Americans drive electric cars or make these changes is kind of what we have in Europe, which is expensive gasoline, right? We have the equivalent of maybe $7 a gallon fuel, right, and gasoline. So then people get creative, and then people say, hey, I want an electric car, whatever. So I see tremendous opportunity in alternative energy, in the whole transportation sector, in the move towards electric cars. But again, carefully, there's investments in car sharing technologies. Car sharing also makes a lot of sense, and it's now very easy with smartphones to do car sharing, where you don't have to put the intelligence in the car. You can just put it in the smartphone, and people leave their smartphones on, and with GPS-enabled applications, they show where the cars are, and so it saves you a lot of money on the car. So already car sharing is a step towards things. So there's tremendous opportunities, but again, I caution the people who are on the call because, unfortunately, I see less of the will and less of – I see that the big oil companies and the decadent are too powerful in a lobbying system and reluctant to change. And so unless oil becomes super expensive, one may lose a lot of money trying to make this investment.
Makes sense. By the way, if anyone would like to ask a question, simply press *6 on your phone to unmute your mic. Again, just go ahead and press *6 on your phone. And that'll turn your mic live, and then you can go ahead and ask Martin a question. Any questions from the audience? Another question that came in, Martin, was in the mobile gaming. I know a number of us have underwritten gaming companies, but to your point, it can be so risky to to bet on individual games. Our last speaker, Brad Feld, had invested in a company, and it wasn't until their ninth or tenth or 11th game that they released called Guitar Hero that they finally had a success, and he had a great return on that investment. Any advice in terms of investing in mobile applications with, you know, knowing that the app stores, I'm not sure what iPhone, you know, what Apple's, you know, app store is up to, but I think it was, you know, over 300,000 individual apps when I last heard of it. And, of course, you've got Androids growing like a weed, now surpassing, Apple in terms of number of devices and bandwidth and all kinds of other metrics. Any advice there in terms of investing within mobile apps or mobile gaming?
Well, this is a sector that is the opposite of what I was saying about alternative energy, that America is the mecca of the world. It has, I mean, I'm friends with Mark Pincus, like who started Zynga, people who, all the mobile Android and iOS, which are the two most successful systems, are being developed very near each other in Cupertino and Mountain View. And America leads the world in this field, right? So, having said this, it is interesting how people who come out of nowhere seem to develop amazing games, because we're living an online world and it doesn't matter anymore where you are really. You have to have the talented and just you can put a game anywhere. So, for example, there's a game called Tiny Wings that is being super successful now that was just developed by a student. So there seems to be no logic to this. There's companies that have been trying, like, and raised a lot of money, like Zynga, and who are leaders. There's, of course, Activision, Blizzard, and some of the biggest gaming companies in the world. And their games were amazing industries, like World of Warcraft. But the good news is that anybody in this call or anybody with $100,000 or $50,000 could potentially make a game that becomes gigantic, right? So that's it. But the barriers to entry are very low, and a lot of people are putting out games. So my advice to people on the call is don't invest in games if you don't like games yourself and you cannot play them, and at least come to your own conclusion as to whether you think this is a good game or not. Now, it's at least you have to have some sense of what the game is like, and play it, and see if you, and of course, there you can ask people, and you can ask probably your own kids if you have them, because some of these games are for younger kids, and just test the game with your kids or nieces or nephews or somebody who may like to play the game. The games are, in the end, something that is downloaded on your iPad or your iPhone, and you have to play. And other than that, it's kind of like, I don't know, would you invest in food without tasting it? You know, probably not. I don't know. So it's about taste and it's about vision. But the winners come out of nowhere, and it's a very risky business too.
Very good. Any additional questions from the audience? Okay, Martin, those were the majority of the questions that were sent over to me. I'm looking at the time, and we are near the end. So maybe instead of going through some of the investments, I wish we had more time. Maybe any final remarks or thoughts before we wrap it up?
Yes. So I just wanted to share with you that my email is martin@fom.com. Very simple, martin@fom.com. If you have any questions that you wanted to address directly to me, I'm interested in collaborating with other people, especially on very early early stage. You can send me ideas. You can also send me products, which is really what I like the most, because I like to both design products and use products. And so you can send me apps or whatever the product may look like. And I'll be happy to collaborate with other people, give my opinion when I have time. So with that, I just would like to thank Michael and everyone here, and I hope to meet some of you in person in the near future.
Well, Martin, thank you so much for taking almost an hour to share your thoughts with so many angels across North America today. Your involvement and dedication to entrepreneurism sets a high benchmark for others to follow. Thank you so much. For all the angel groups, for all the angel groups that were able to join us across North America, we appreciate your participating. The next knowledge event is going to be on April 7th. It'll be Laura Flanagan. Her topic will be tips on due diligence, governance, and designing exits. In June, we've got Jeff Clavier, one of the more prominent angel investors in North America from SoftTech VC, talking about capital-efficient lean startups, myth and realities. We've then got Josh Koppelman in August discussing helping your portfolio companies to the next level. And then we've got Reid Hoffman, the founder of Greylock, and the founder of LinkedIn and a partner with Greylock, talking about internet and internet investing 2.0 in September. If you'd like further details on the times and the exact dates, just go to angelpool.org and click on the knowledge tab, and you'll see that information there. With that, I think that we are concluded. Thank you all so much for joining. The call is now concluded. Martin, thank you again. Have a great day. Or in your case, Martin.
Thank you. It was great.
Have a great evening. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're about to end this meeting. You're the only person still in the...
John. How are you?
Hey, good.
Good.
Hey, quick question. I'm just going back and forth with Compass because I guess it's a little bit more complex than just sending over their 16 million record database. You need all 16 million records, right?
Right.
You would love all those selects, like we talked about,
mm-hmm.
and all of their URLs.
That's right.
And I think they're cool with that before we have the contract signed and all that, because what they're trying to do is, remember, like I said, they have a need for that finalized deal because Dun & Bradstreet's knocking on the door and a couple other of their customers are there.
Okay.
That are, so I just want to make sure, because I'm just wondering if they're having trouble getting it to us by this weekend. So I think that's kind of what's on the table right now. I thought it was pretty clear that we needed everything. I think he thought we just needed the 3.5 million URLs so that we could match up all of our emails to the URLs. I think he's going to ask me, so what is your process this weekend, so that he kind of understands?
Well, on in terms of what I'll be doing,
yeah.
There'll be, a couple hundred steps, but
sure.
It's mostly preparing the database for us, where I'm going to be, trying to figure out from all our names, from the least cost to the most cost, starting with the worst, the free data to us, which emails were verified, working back, overriding address, old addresses, old phones, old SICs with current stuff on those companies where our, data might be old or bad, to create a consistent, record across all, across all of them, et cetera.
Exactly. Because remember, what part of this is we're trying to get that same database ready for them so that they know what they can sell to D&D and to other big customers where we're going to split it 50-50. So I want to just make sure that I understand what the output is.
The output would then be the all of the names from our side where the email was working, cross-pollinated with their, address, city, state, zip, SIC, and firmographic data.
Gotcha. Now, will you use this as the one question I think that they're going to, because in the end, what they want to make sure is that for every address that they have, company with the URL that they have, where we have additional emails, that they have a source file that they know that's their sourced postal telemarketing SIC record. For by and large, that's what we're going to end up with, correct? But
well,
you're saying you're going to also do some things in ours to give it hierarchy based on what the cost is for us.
Well, I wouldn't say that to them, but
sure.
But yes.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to do is say in the end, because what I committed to them is that after this whole approach, we would be delivering back the master file to them that they could then in turn go out and see what they could do about selling on our joint behalf.
Okay.
And that would be a true statement that we will be able to deliver that after the weekend, correct?
Well, maybe not after the weekend, but certainly by Friday of next week that would be our intent.
Excellent. Okay. Then what I will do is make sure that I do everything I can to get a hold of that full file, because I think what they were thinking is that for this update they were going to do some of that heavy lifting, and what I'm worried about is they might not now be able to get us that full file. So I think that what they were thinking we were going to do is they were going to provide us with URLs before everything got done so that we could say, okay, here are each of the emails that we have that are good deliverable emails associated with the following URLs. And then what they would do is they would match them all up and do their own database, kind of count, if you will. So
now, if they want to do their own database work, they're welcome to do it. We just can't release our stuff, knowing that some of our addresses are 7 years old.
Oh, of course, yeah. I think the best deal is to put it all in your hands. Have you go through your hygiene process, make sure everything's matched up, say this is what we think is the best net deal. Because in the end, their addresses, if we have an email associated with one of their addresses with normalized firmographics and things, it's probably the best one for us to use regardless.
Yeah, I think so. Now, where we know the person's in a different state, then I need to kind of decide what to do because, but I'll come across that, as I do during the process.
Okay, great. Because in some cases, you're going to have addresses on the ones that we have, correct?
Well, in many cases, I would have the address. The question is if it's an IBM, if it's IBM and they've got, New Yorker Drive and, in New York, would I want to overwrite, every employee at IBM, with that?
Exactly.
The employee in Florida that we've got in our database and is in Florida, even though that address is 7 years old, what do I do about that?
Exactly.
So I needed to make a decision there, sometime okay. over the weekend as I'm doing this.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, well, I will do everything within my power. I'm getting on the phone with him right now to try to see what we can do about getting all the data, all the stuff, so that we have one good, solid database.
Okay.
Okay, man. Thanks.
All right.
Bye. Bye.
How do you get me, you, and Haley a ticket for that play for tomorrow night?
Let me check my calendar.
Tomorrow night's Friday.
What time is it?
Mm-hmm. It starts at 7, but we need to be there.
Can't, you know, maybe.
Well, it's not.
Well, to be in that line, they don't open until 5. You're better off just getting it for you and him.
Oh. Thank you.
So where are we going?
To back to Fort Myers, you know, not Naples.
Not Naples?
To Naples.
Oh, were you able to get the Naples Grand or whatever?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really? For how much?
Yeah, no bargain, you know.
$350?
$300.
Yeah. What were there?
Hey, can you come back to me a little bit? This is kind of complicated.
I don't need to come back at
Thank you for calling Hilton Honors Worldwide. To redeem points for Hilton Honors free nights reservations, press 1. If you have an existing reservation and would like to... For reservations at a Hilton hotel, press 1. For Hilton Garden Inn, press 2. For Hampton, press 3. For Embassy Suites, press 4. For DoubleTree, press 5. For Homewood Suites by Hilton, press 6. For Conrad Hotels, press 7. To redeem Hilton Honors points for any other Hilton Honors reward, press 8. To repeat this menu, press 9. To please enter your Hilton Honors number followed by the pound sign. If you don't have it, please press the star key. Thank you. Just a moment. I'll get someone to help you. Transferring you now. To ensure quality, this call may be monitored or recorded.
Calling Hilton Redemption Desk. This is Dan. How can I help you?
Yes, I was trying to make a reservation at the Naples Beach Resort, and I was trying to use some of my points for it, but your interface is very, very confusing.
I'm sorry about that. Mr. Price, can I have the phone number you've given us?
I don't know what would be any record, but my phone number is 770-998-9999.
I see I have 140,479 points, a silver card holder, and coming back, what was the arrival date in Naples?
That would be April 7th, departing April 10th at the Naples Grand Beach Resort.
Okay, one moment, I'll catch up with you. The computer wanted to put you in Italy. One moment. And how many adults and children?
Two adults, two kids.
And may I have the ages of the children?
16 and 11. I guess 15 and 11.
Okay. One moment. Let me see how many points that location requires. And there's Naples Grand Beach Resort.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Waldorf Astoria collection, and they have high and low seasons. Let me see if it's going to be high or low season there. And if a standard room's available, one moment. Pull that up. Right, it is going to be high season. Let me go see how many points that that's going to require. One moment.
Okay.
Yeah, the Waldorf Astoria Collection hotels, they are kind of difficult to navigate. I admit that. Let's see, one moment. During high season, it's 60,000 points per night. Let's see.
So I guess what I want to do is then, get two nights through the points, and I guess I'll pay for two nights.
All right. We're running into a problem, though. I just noticed when I tried to put logos in, I don't have any standard rooms left at that particular property. Would you like me to check the Edgewater Beach property?
No, that would be it. So it's they've got it black. They've got points not allowed.
Only standard rooms are available. Upgraded rooms aren't available. If you'd like to book an upgraded room.
No, I just want to, they've got plenty of standard rooms online, for pay.
All right. I'm not sure if there are any standard rooms.
I mean, I'm about to book it and give money.
Of course, I'm not showing if those are standard rooms that are left.
Do they have, three standard rooms at the... And the rest are... I guess that's a smart way of blackballing point usage, huh? Just have a very small number of
standard rooms. Anything else I can help you with? Only standard rooms are available, sir. I mean, if you want to book a standard room, there's none available during those days. We're not trying to...
Let me check one thing. Hold on a second.
Sure. You did say April 10th for one night, right?
No, I said April 7th, checking out April 10th.
So you'll be short enough points for a three-night stay.
Were you checking just for the 10th?
Yes, sir.
If you can recheck it, obviously, unless you're already doing it.
I'll be happy to. One moment. It's not available.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry we couldn't help you, but as
calling Hilton Honors Worldwide. To redeem points for Hilton Honors free nights reservations, press 1. If you have an existing reservation and would like to modify, cancel, or reconfirm, press 2. To make a new reservation, press 3. If you want to make changes to your Hilton Honors account information, press 4. For all other Honors account information, to redeem non-hotel reward or to enroll.
My fucking God. you like that, huh?